This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. The process of composing a short story or novel can be, pick your adjective, daunting, maddening, relatively painless, or hopefully rewarding. This hour, we hear the story of author Robin Black. She flirted with the idea of writing for much of her young adulthood, and yet could not really embrace it until she was about 40, after the death of her father. Even then, the process was far from easy. Black had experienced divorce, remarriage, motherhood, agoraphobia, ADD, and eventually success as a writer. And she addresses all of this in her latest work, Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide, a book which is part memoir and part literary analysis. Robin Black, nice to have you here for Radio Times.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
So I've read a quote of yours which says, "You are not a writer who always wanted to be a writer." Let's begin with a bit of your history.
No, I'm not. Actually, when I was growing up, I was certain I was going to be an actress. That was it. I was going to be on stage and screen, and I went off to college at Sarah Lawrence with that in mind. I'd also studied voice for years, and I was absolutely set on this. And that was one of my earlier self-sabotage moments. I got to Sarah Lawrence, and I looked at the theater kids who were very kind of New York sophisticate, and I was this semi-preppy, semi-bohemian person from Connecticut, and I just froze, and I never took a single acting class. And I had done all the plays in high school, you know, as so many of us do, I guess. That was it for me. I just walked away terrified.
And where did writing fit into all this?
My second year at college, when I was 19, I took a writing class with Alan Gerganis, who is, you know, absolutely brilliant and warm and compassionate. And at that point, after that class, I thought, well, I'm definitely going to be a writer. I love being a writer. And once again, I just sabotaged myself and couldn't do it, couldn't follow through.
Well, let's talk about what happens over the course of the next 20 years, because you're a person who really got going in your career in midlife.
Yes.
So your young adulthood, there was a lot going on, as we mentioned in the introduction, marriage, divorce, remarriage, children, and also some mental health challenges.
Absolutely. I was married at 23, divorced at 30. I was lost two babies in pregnancy, actually. So I was pregnant sort of every other year for 10 years. Mm. And the mental health challenges largely took the form of some depression, but more anxiety, panic, fear of leaving the house, fear of being in the outside world. I remember at some point when I was in my 20s calling somebody and saying, "You're going to be so proud of me. I went to the grocery store by myself and made it home with the groceries," which was a big change from going to the grocery store by myself and either never getting into the grocery store or filling a basket and thinking something bad is going to happen and running home. So I dealt for really 20-ish years with quite severe anxiety, most of which just kept me in the house as much as I could possibly manage.
And during that time, what were you thinking of writing? Were you thinking of it at all? Was it in the back of your mind? Were you kind of feeling badly because you couldn't attack it? What was going on?
I was making sporadic attempts. I would join writing groups and stick with them a little bit and then let it go and quit and get frustrated and decide I was no good at it and decide it was what I really, really wanted to do with my life and cycle through that again and quit. And it really, I mean, looking at it now from this distance, it's pretty obvious that something was wrong in the process. I mean, at the time, it felt wrong, but it felt like something external, like, oh, why doesn't my life allow me to do the things that I'm going to find fulfilling? But in fact, I think there was just a huge amount of self-censoring, maybe, is the way to put it.
You're pretty open about your ADD diagnosis. You've devoted part of your webpage to it. Mm-hmm. So when did you realize that this is part of what was going on with you?
I was in my early 40s when I was diagnosed, and at the time, which was a little over 10 years ago, that was pretty much the average diagnosis time for women, was in their 40s, because other women had what happened to them, what happened to me, which was having a child diagnosed and sitting there in the room listening to the syndromes and listening to the frustrations and thinking, wait a minute, that's what I went through. I was a terrible student as a young person. I graduated at the absolute rock bottom of my high school class. I didn't understand anything about systems, doing homework. I was a mess and couldn't finish things, couldn't complete things, which I'm sure also has played into what delayed my writing for so long, just being, you know, particularly bad at follow through. And then my youngest child was diagnosed with ADD, among other things. And when that happened, I had that light bulb moment of just saying, wait a minute. And I went to a therapist and I said, I'm pretty sure I should get tested. And I went down to the ADD clinic at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, and I took all the tests. And at one point, I was just messing up hideously with puzzles. I couldn't do them. And this very nice young woman who was monitoring said, oh, don't worry, that's okay. And I was like, no, you don't understand. This is so good. This is confirming that there's something actually kind of a loose wire somewhere. It's not that I didn't succeed at things because I'm a bad person, which is sort of the thing that haunts everybody who has ADD, is this kind of vague shame and having the word lazy attached to them and just feeling
disorganized,
all the negatives. And so for me, it was, I mean, I cried when I got the diagnosis because it was just unbearably moving to me that there was an explanation for a kind of failure that had followed me through 40 years of life. Not the only explanation, but a pretty critical one. And then I just started looking into what you take and what you do and how you cope. And it was hugely improving.
So it sounds as if your diagnosis and your treatment in your early 40s kind of dovetails with another major event in your life. And I'd like to kind of back into the story of your dad and your relationship with your dad. And this all precedes you jumping into the writing with both feet. So we're going to get there. But I'm going to back into it with Harper Lee's Ghosts at a Watchman. And it'll become clear, hopefully, as we go along, why we're going this way. It was released, of course, last year. There's a huge hubbub about the release. A lot of people, you know, many people read it. Many didn't want to read it because of the portrayal of Atticus Finch, the character from To Kill a Mockingbird. You could not read that book. Why not?
At the time when it came out, I reacted as much to the description of the book as to people's reaction, or vice versa, as much to people's reactions. And I was on Facebook, as we most of us are, and people were absolutely scandalized at the idea that Atticus Finch was being revealed to be something other than 100% purely heroic and virtuous and completely on target with all issues of race and equality. And it resonated for me very deeply because my father, Charles Black, was a fairly prominent civil rights lawyer. He was one of the authors of the Brown versus Board of Ed brief with the NAACP Defense Fund. And a lot of my life and understanding my life has been trying to understand a man who can be both good, as my father was, and also have, you know, significant feet of clay. And I wouldn't put his don't go in the same category of as Finch's in that it wasn't about race. There wasn't, you know, ambiguous badness on that subject, but just that he was profoundly flawed and emotionally ill, I think is a fair word.
But before we get to the break, why don't you read a passage from your book, Crash Course, which describes your father, kind of draws a portrait.
Okay. He never became a household name, but he was a massive figure in his field, legal academia, well known for his work on civil rights and through his writings in opposition to the death penalty. At Yale and Columbia Law Schools, where he taught for nearly a half century combined, he educated scores of future leaders of every kind. When he died, his obituary ran a third of a page in the New York Times, a fact about which he himself would have been thrilled. And it was impossible not to be swept into his orbit. For much of my life, upon meeting people, I led with the fact of being his daughter. It seemed much more important an aspect of my identity than anything for which I might ever be responsible, and it also seemed somehow required of me.
Tellingly, you really did not start to write, and as you put it, write and write and write until he passed away. Why not?
I did. I started writing 3 weeks after he died, and it took me another 5 years to put the timing together and say, oh, you know, maybe Dad's absence had some sort of freeing impact on me. You know, I'm always wary of portraying my father as a bad person because he wasn't. He was complicated and difficult. And I think in the case of my writing, one of the things that my father conveyed to me, and I won't speak for my brothers, but to me as his child, was really not the kind of parental encouragement you hope that your child will surpass you or will achieve what you have achieved. I think my father was very afraid of not being the most successful person in a room. So I think that, not that I had any great conviction that if I sit down to write, I will be successful, but that I guess on some level I had the conviction or the understanding that if I try to be successful at anything really, I'm kind of violating an unspoken contract between my father and me.
So what was going on in your head then when you sat down and all of a sudden you started to write and write and write? Were there a whole bunch of stories, things stored up that just had to be put to paper?
I started with nonfiction. The first thing I wrote was actually an exploration of a family dynamic around religion. And it was an essay, and it was sort of odd in form. And then all of a sudden, I, who had really never thought of, I had never thought of myself as particularly imaginative in the kind of making things up way, I really did discover this well of imagined situations and people who don't really exist and characters sort of, you know, yearning to come out. And it was pretty powerful. I mean, for the first few years, I think a combination of just having been so blocked and having all this pushed down, and also at the same time kind of having a glimmer that this might result in my having an identity apart from being my father's daughter, I was obsessed with it. I mean, my husband and I would go out to dinner. My husband is a very patient man. And we'd be sitting there, and I guess I'd be staring off into space, and he would say to me, Robin, are you writing? And I would say, oh, yeah, I am. But it felt like this was going to be it. And you have to understand that I was coming from a place where, actually, this was a couple years later, but it sums up where I was in my head. I was at a conference, and somebody said, I'm writing a paper on the subject of failure, and if any of you have any experiences that you'd like to recount, I'd love to hear them. And I raised my hand and said, I am failure. It defines me. That's who I am.
Wow.
And that was really what I got from the first 40 years of my life. So when I began an activity that I thought, and I will just say as an aside, that is not uncommon for people with ADD or ADHD. You know, that's the reason I have it on my website.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation in just a moment here on Radio Times. Author Robin Black is with us this hour. Her newest book is Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation here on Radio Times, the number to call is 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Mosgawain. Stay with us for more. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Mosgawain, and we are chatting with author Robin Black. Her new book is Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide. And if you've got a question or a comment, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So Robin Black, we were just getting into the start of your career as a writer, and you're just kind of starting to get a lot of this stuff on paper. The writer's mantra is write what you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you say, I think, in this book, write the book that's missing on your shelf.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I have a kind of checkered past with novel writing. The short stories came very naturally to me, and I actually still love the form. I mean, there's just something about it that really speaks to me, and I'm on a mission to convince readers that it can speak to them as well. But when it came to novel writing, I tried one that failed, and the trying took 4 years. It wasn't the only thing I was working on at the time, but it took a good chunk of 4 years. And I had to admit that, you know, it wasn't ever going to soar. It wasn't ever going to be something I was proud of. So I pulled it and I started again. And it's very difficult in this day and age, maybe particularly with Facebook, with Twitter, with everything, not to try to emulate other writers, not to try to say, oh, you know, I'm writing domestic dramas or I'm writing historical novels or whatever it is you're writing and look at some other genre and say what I should be writing is, you know, high concept novels because that's what's selling right now. So those thoughts can be very distracting when you're trying to get a project started. And really the kind of guiding star for me throughout was not what do I think other people want to read, not what do I think will sell, but what is the book I would like to sit down on a rainy day in an armchair and read. And that was kind of kept me focused and kept my priorities straight, I would say.
And I should say you have taught writing in addition to being a writer, and you're going to be teaching at Rutgers Camden mm-hmm. coming up. So so when you start, and I know you have these characters in your head, how do you put the first line to paper? What do you do?
I usually start not so much with characters or with a plot, but just with a kind of sense of something. And it's always a kind of unsatisfying answer because I can't do much better than that. But maybe I've observed an interaction between two people and I think, oh, that's an interesting thing about how humans interact. And I kind of start there. I will say that where the first line comes from, like much of my writing, is a complete mystery to me. I find this process really bizarre. I mean, I've been doing it for 15 years or so, and you would think, you know, I would sort of be used to it by now. But sometimes I'll go back and I'll read a few pages I wrote and I'll say, why did I think of that? Like, why did I give him, you know, a striped tie that's frayed at the edge? You know, that isn't something that has particular meaning in my life. Yet the imagination just sort of spews this stuff out. And I do try, and I do advise students also and colleagues that with the first draft, there should be as little thought as possible. The unfortunate phrase I use is it should be as much like vomiting as possible.
Oh, okay.
You know, just
vomiting words.
Yeah, it's just coming out, and you're not judging it for quality now. Mm-hmm.
And then you go back and do what you call, is it ripping out stitches?
There's a certain amount of ripping out stitches, which for me is accepting the inevitability of the fact that it's not going to be right. You know, even if at 5 o'clock in the afternoon before I start making dinner or before I walk the dog, I think, wow, I had a great writing day today. 9 o'clock the next morning, the chances are better than even that I'll go back to the computer and say, oh, what was I thinking? So you have to, and I think, again, I think that that's true of almost every writer, if not every writer. So there is this way in which you have to keep kind of nimble as to the question of how well am I doing this? Because your own assessment of it is going to change so drastically hour to hour, day to day. And that's before you even get into what are the critics saying? What are the readers saying?
Mm-hmm. So, and again, kind of while we're at the beginning of the process, you say there's apparently a default man who is waiting at your keyboard. Who's the default man? What is he?
The default man is this guy who just appears in my work, and he's very distinctive. He has a one-syllable name, something like Jack or Chuck, something kind of simple. He's kind of a humble guy, sort of good-looking, middle-aged, a little also like that tie, a little frayed around the edges. And he isn't anyone I've ever met. He is definitely not my father, not my brothers, not my husband. And I don't know where he came from, but my theory about him is that because going into your imagination and writing can be so scary, and certainly has been in my life, that he's kind of like my imaginary friend who keeps me company until I go back and change him into a more distinct character. But there's something about him that sort of says, okay, Robin, we're going to do this together. We're going to start another story. And it sounds crazy, I think. But if you think about it, sitting in your room all day and making people up for a living is a little crazy. Yeah. You know,
he sounds like he's just part of the creative process.
He definitely is. And he's always there. And I used to get frustrated because every man I wrote was the same man. And now I'm far enough down the line that I know, okay, in that first draft where I'm not thinking, it's going to be Chuck or Jack or Hank. But then when I go back and revise, I can make him into the person that that particular story needs.
Yeah. Well, and imaginary people aside, you also draw from real life, especially in these essays in Crash Course. For instance, in talking about your ADD, you talk about your husband. He sounds like a wonderful guy and a bit of a saint. The story of the 4-hour round trip in which he goes to retrieve the wallet you left behind.
It's by no means the only time he's done it.
How do you write about this and write about your husband and your daughter and the challenges she faces and not perhaps cross the line with your family so that they would be miserable with what you wrote, or should there even be a line?
You know, writers disagree about this, pretty vehemently, because I think that in particular, people who feel that there should not be a line are defending their own line pretty hard because they come under attack from family members, from people who think, oh, they shouldn't have told that, they shouldn't have spilled that. I will admit to having a somewhat more boundaried, I guess. And I don't mean that to be pejorative about people who make other decisions, but I won't tell secrets. I'm not telling anybody else's secrets. And the stuff that I tell in this book, some of which is extremely personal about me, is by definition not a secret because here it is in a book. But I wouldn't write something that would make my husband feel humiliated. Mm. Not that there's much he's done that could do that. In that essay that you mentioned, he smashes one of our cars into the other car. And I did feel some trepidation about putting that in there just because thinking, it wasn't his most shining moment.
He seems like a human being, Robin.
Yeah, exactly. It humanizes him. Yeah. But he was fine with it. And of course, the more sensitive issue is my daughter, who has learning disabilities and some language processing disabilities. And I've been extremely cautious over time. She's 20 now, about not divulging anything that might embarrass her, and when I say I've been cautious, I mean it's something she and I have really talked about, collaborated on. And she's a wonderful, brilliant young woman herself, and she is pretty set on the idea that the stuff that she's gone through because of these various special needs, she wants that out in the world. She wants it to help other people. The book is dedicated to her because really the story of my life is in some ways the story of my learning how to be open from my daughter.
We are chatting with Robin Black, whose new book is called Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide. The number is 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And we have an email from Michelle. She writes, "Hi, awesome show. Thank you. I've been living inside this conversation for forever, taken writing classes. Most were not great, but I want to write. So how do you not get distracted, discouraged, and overwhelmed by the process of writing, and even scarier, publishing? Thank you so much, and good luck with your writing," she says.
Thank you, Michelle. Good luck with your writing. I wish there were a magic answer, but there isn't. But I will give you some advice. One of the things that kept me on track in the early days, and you don't say what the distractions are exactly, but I always tell people who are starting out to put a piece of paper on their computer screen or on their laptop that says, "Nobody ever has to read a word I write." Because I think one of the distracting factors for many people in the beginning is self-consciousness and is, oh, I really want to write this story, but I'm afraid if my mother reads it or my husband or my children or whoever it is. And you need to feel free, even if you go back and, as I said, have boundaries or decide, ooh, I really wrote this one for myself. I don't want anyone to see it. The stuff that you want to show the world will not come out unless you free yourself to write everything that might come out. And I think that's very important. As for organizing time, I am the last person to ask about that. I'm Mrs. ADD. I wander around my house and sit down and write for 5 minutes at a time.
And you have music playing. You say you've got certain things that have to be kind of in place while you're writing.
I have I should say, first of all, I do medicate for ADD, which has helped me, though, of course, it might not help anybody else. I will often put a single song on an infinite loop because there's something about the mood of it that just, you know, goes with what I'm trying to write. Because when you have ADD, having a kind of, I don't even know what the term is, but a kind of anchor distraction is how I think of it, can be helpful in helping you focus. And, I mean, there are a couple of Adele songs that just, like, kind of wrote my novel for me, which is, you know, there's definitely that kind of sad Adele, you know, regret theme going through it. But I've also written stories to Elvis Costello. I mean, it varies.
So Michelle had also referenced publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think you've got a work that you're ready to publish, where do you even begin?
Well, I think the first clause of that question is really the important part, when you think you've got a work ready to publish, because a lot of people, and I was guilty of this, kind of mess up the writing process because they worry about publication too soon. And they, you know, people who have published a few stories want an agent, but agents don't want a few stories, they want a book. So people start being anxious about aspects of the career that really are kind of miles ahead of them. And believe me, there's time enough to get anxious about them when they're not. But I came up in the era of literary magazines. So even 15 years ago, when I started publishing, 13 years ago, there really were very few online publications. And so I would send to university presses and kind of the old-fashioned route. And we did not do it through Submittable, which is one of the programs that people use now. We did it with self-addressed stamped envelopes. And because I have ADD, that often meant that for 6 months there would be self-addressed stamped envelopes on my bedroom floor. And then I'd say, oh, all the dates on my cover letters are out. I better try this again. But I'm a great believer in sending things out, in listening to the response. If you send a story out and nobody wants it, it may not mean it's a bad story. It may mean you need to go back into it. And by nobody, I should explain the numbers a little bit. The average story that is published is rejected something like 100 times.
100.
So people who get, you know, 5 or 6 rejections and think, oh, no, I'm doomed, this story is no good, you got to kind of get back on it and send it out some more.
Tenacity.
Yep. Mm.
All right, let's get to the phones. Ashley in Newark, Delaware, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome, Ashley.
Welcome, Marty. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, Robin. Thank you so much for being on the radio today. It's been so wonderful hearing your story.
I'm so glad to share it.
Thank you. So I have a question. I've been writing for about a year and a half now. I've kind of had a very similar life story to you, with kind of coming to this realization that I have ADD as an adult, and I'm learning how to cope with that lack of fulfillment when I start a project and then I don't finish it. But as a writer, I really connect to what you had shared with. You look at one day and you say, what a great day of writing, and you kind of call it quits for the day, and you wake up the next morning feeling so excited for your progress from the day prior, only to read your work and want to tear it apart and say, oh, I'm not making any progress, I need to rewrite the entire chapter. So I'm curious what advice you have for people similar to you and to me, where we write and then tear it apart only to rewrite again, and it feels as though I'm really not making much progress, even though pages continue to grow. I feel as though I just keep tearing it apart only to feel like I have to start again.
Well, thank you, Ashley, for the call to Radio Times. Robin?
It's certainly a familiar story. I mean, it's certainly a pattern that I and probably a lot of writers relate to. And when I started out, and I was about where you are, about a year and a half or 2 years in, I wrote to Alan Gerganis, who had been my writing teacher 20 years before. And he said something very smart to me. He said, put yourself in situations where you're around other people who are at the same stage and who are also starting out, who have a few stories to show, people who are at the same point of concerns about the future, lack of confidence. So I'm hoping that you do have some writer friends. And if not, I hope, you know, you'll look, and even online courses now, which are something that weren't there 15 years ago, can give you that sense of community. Because I think it's very important to understand that the things you're describing are not just you. So that kind of gets you over the hurdle of thinking, well, because I don't like my work the next day, it must mean I shouldn't be a writer. And I can tell you that every writer doesn't like their work the next day. So if we all took that attitude, we'd all have quit long ago. So you have to accept it as part of the process and just talk about it a lot with people who are trying to do the same stuff.
Would it be a good idea to get a hold of a good editor who can really look at your stuff and give you some good advice?
Not yet. For somebody who's been writing for a year and a half, if a person writes, you know, a draft of a messy novel and they really have no idea what it is or what it isn't, whether it's working, then having an editor, and there are plenty out there for hire, you know, having an editor look at it isn't a bad thing to do. But I'm really wary with people who are just starting out of introducing them to anyone who's in the profession, as opposed to aspiring to it or teaching. People who are in publishing have their eyes focused on what sells. I mean, there are many wonderful editors out there who are editing just for quality, but in a way that the sort of protective mama bird part of me wants to say, oh, you've only been writing an hour and a half. Don't even think about, a year and a half. Don't even think about editors, you know, just
how long
just
would you say
going.
Then? How long do you want them to keep going?
It depends on what they're writing. I mean, I think there are people who out of the chute write a book that should be sent to an agent right away. But it sounds like she's at a more kind of tender phase than that. And it would be hard to find editors who will look at, you know, kind of the tentative beginnings of a career.
So keep somehow words of advice to keep her going and getting past that block, that feeling of hopelessness would be just
know other writers and realize it's not just you.
Okay. We're up against a break and we'll be back in just a moment with author Robin Black. Her new book is Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. And again, the telephone number is 888-477-9499. More just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane, and we are chatting with author Robin Black. Her new book is called Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, it's as simple as giving us a call at 888-477-9499, our email radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works as well at WHYY Radio Times. So we have a couple comments, Robin. Let's get to them. Tweet from Nina. She says, how did you overcome the embarrassment of facing your diagnosis? And I'm assuming that's for the ADD.
It's a really great question. I think that by the time I was diagnosed, I'd been through the experience of watching a child be diagnosed with ADD, and I was very clear that I didn't want her to feel embarrassed, that I wanted her to feel empowered by the diagnosis. So then, in a sense, when I was diagnosed, I had to walk the walk. And absolutely, it can be shameful. It can feel shameful. It can't be, but it can feel shameful. But for me, I think what helped me not feel ashamed of it was that it explained so many behaviors from me and so many failures that had been much more embarrassing than the diagnosis. And the diagnosis was an explanation. But I will say the other thing that helped me overcome it is that as soon as I articulated it, so many people I knew said, oh, me too. You are just so far from alone with this. It's a large number of us who are out there.
And we have an email from Sue who says, love the discussion, especially about writing and drafts. As Sister Corita Kent said in her 10 Rules for Art, Rule 4, consider everything an experiment.
Absolutely. Or as I sometimes say to students, in the beginning, it's all mud pies. It's just get in there and play with it.
Yeah, have fun with it.
Yep.
Inherent in that. Okay, so back to the nuts and bolts, Robin Black. You write, we writers are terrified a reader won't turn from one page to the next. And this really goes to the heart of a narrative structure, doesn't it?
It really does. And it's, you know, we teach writing classes and we talk about it and we talk about all these complicated things, point of view choices, narrative distance, all this stuff. And sometimes it's just really helpful to get back to the idea that your job as a writer is to make someone want to turn the page. And there are so many different ways to approach that. But it puts a writer, thinking of it that way, puts a writer back, I think, into kind of communication mode, where you realize I'm not just writing into the air in my room. I'm not writing, as my Texan grandmother would have said, to hear my own head rattle. I'm writing to talk to somebody, and I want them to be interested. So that's kind of the central goal there.
Okay. And another writer's nightmare, you're knee-deep into creating a story, and you discover that a major element doesn't seem to work. So what do you do there? A, you carry on, somehow make it work. B, chuck it, start over. Or is there C?
One thing you can do is show it to someone you trust. Emphasis on trust. Because when you use outside readers, you really have to make sure it's people who support what you're doing and believe in it. But I would say that the question of when to throw something out, which is the unnice way of saying, you know, leave it on your hard drive and maybe get back to it one day, is a really tough one for all of us. I've done it with an entire novel because a lot wasn't working.
It must have been hard.
It was
heartbreaking.
It was a little tough. It was
all that time.
Yeah, it was a lot of time, and it was, it was to me, I had to make sure not to put it in the category with every other failure, and sort of say, okay, this is just the process of learning to write a novel. This isn't happening because I'm Robin Black and I don't finish things. It's happening for some other reason. But I sometimes with students after, you know, if we go through many drafts of a story and it's still really not fully realized, but they've drafted it maybe 4 times, 5 times, I will say to them, you know, I think that at least for now, this story has probably taught you all it has to teach you. And we've used it as a learning vessel in a sense. Let's step away from it. And the great thing about computers is it's all there. You know, whether you ever go back to it or not, you can just tell yourself you will go back to it. I mean, I have dozens and dozens of incomplete stories on my hard drive and on some hard drives I no longer own anymore.
All right, let's get back to the phones. William in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Welcome to Radio Times, William.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I write and deliver sermons on a weekly basis, and a full-time father of 3 and a full-time husband. And I used to write creatively as a kid, you know, in school. And so I think one of the things is we have to continue to encourage creative writing in our elementary schools, because that's where my love of writing was first nurtured. But my question is, how do you have any advice on how to get back for people like me who are just inundated with living in life and so much more, who used to write creatively, who used to make time for poetry and other acts of writing, but now just we don't have the time and we don't have what we used to have back then.
You really miss it, William?
I do, and I try to writing and delivering my sermons doesn't always, I try to put some creativity to it, you know, same way that someone wants to turn the page, I want someone to listen to the sermon with that same, well, what's he going to say next? But I think it's very distinctive, but I think there's some overlap, and I try to find that overlap, but
sure.
I also want to make time for the fullness of the creativity that writing can offer.
All right, William, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
I think that's such a great question, and I love the notion, and I think it's very true, of sermons as real literature and approaching them in the same way. What I would say about time is that I think that some people give up on finding time because they're trying to find enough time, and that sometimes the thing to do is to just say, okay, 20 minutes every other day or 20 minutes on Fridays. And anything you can grant yourself to get back in that space is a starting point. And I think that a lot of times what can happen is if you spend those 20 minutes every other day writing poetry, I think you said is what you were writing, then the passion to do it can grow and grow from just that tiny, tiny bit of time that you give to it. And you may find yourself making more time. But I think that the real key is to say, rather than have my impulse to write poetry just be extinguished completely, it's better to give it 15 minutes a day. It's better to give it 10 minutes a day. and start small and know that even if it's 10 minutes a day, if you're writing poetry, you are a poet.
Robin, you are asked at times, how do you know when to end a story? Some people, I think, write the ending first. Mm-hmm. How do you manage that, and how do you know?
It used to be, and this is like so embarrassing and corny, it used to be that I knew I had kind of stuck the landing, as I think of it, because I would burst into tears and I would think, okay, I did it. That's the story. Okay, good.
You just had a feeling.
I just sort of had a gut reaction. I'm not sure I do that anymore. That dates back. I try when I'm writing, you know, you run into two different groups of people. There are writers who do outlines and there are writers who don't do outlines. I'm very committed in my own work to not doing an outline, because when I used to do them and try them, it would look like paint by numbers at the end of the process. It was like, oh, right, in this scene, they're supposed to have a fight, so I'll have them have a fight. I try to do what I call keeping myself a little stupid about my own work, so I don't know how it's going to end. I had this with the novel I published. I wrote it in order, and there's a certain degree of mystery in it, and I didn't know the answers until I got to the places. So I think it's probably a good idea for most writers. I hate to give advice to everyone, and I don't think there are rules for this, but to at least be flexible about your ending. I think sometimes when writers know the end from the beginning, they find themselves writing toward that as opposed to kind of paying attention to intuitions about human interaction or hunches about their characters. So while I recognize that some people do need outlines, some people benefit from them, I kind of hope that even as they're doing that, they're keeping themselves a little flexible.
Do you like to keep the reader hungry for more about the characters at the end?
I guess I do. I mean, with my novel, a lot of times when I talk to book groups about it, they'll say, you know, what happened the next year? And my answer is always, I don't know. What do you think happened? Because you do want people to walk away from the work kind of continuing to make it up for themselves.
You're talking about life drawing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't want someone to close the book and say, well, that's over. You want them to walk away and say, wow, I wonder what happened to Gus the next year. I wonder where Allison went.
And you don't want to, you don't want to stay too long.
No. You want to leave them exactly in the right place. And that really is some of the trick of it.
All right. Rachel in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, joins us now on Radio Times. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
So I have spent a 30-year career writing, but for PR and journalism, and in fact, teach writing at Temple right now for those fields. And yet I've always wanted to write creative nonfiction or write a novel. And when I say that to my writer friends who are published, talk about taking a course or getting a master's, they always say, you're a writer. You don't need to do that. And yet I hear you talking about narrative and storyline and timing and transitions, and I don't really know anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what your thoughts are about how do you transition in that way to being able to write in a different format, and whether it's better to get yourself some education and take a course or a workshop.
Okay. Thanks, Rachel.
I'm a big believer in learning craft. When I started going to workshops 15 years ago, I didn't know what point of view was. I didn't know anything, which is actually kind of amazing because I probably had known it when I was 19. But somehow all the children had, you know, my children had knocked that knowledge out of my head. But I will respectfully disagree with your friends and say that although a writer is a writer is a writer, different forms have different conventions and have different craft elements to them. And I honestly can't imagine writing fiction without knowing some of that. And I'll also say there's tremendous joy in learning it. It's really fun, if you want to write fiction, to learn how to write fiction. Again, not that there is one way, not that there are rules, but there are conventions and there are tricks and there are tools. And so I'm going to say, you know, go find yourself a workshop. Go find yourself a teacher. I'm going to be the voice against your friends.
You bring up an interesting point in Crash Course. You found in your own personal experience, it's difficult to get men to read fiction written by women. Why do you think that is?
It's my experience. It's also a well-documented fact that while women will read fiction by men you know, statistically speaking, won't. There are always exceptions, and we all, you know, are glad for them. I have had the most amazing conversations. I'm not going to hypothesize about it on a general social level. I will say that I have talked to men who have said to me, men just feel girly if they read women's stuff.
Well, they think it's going to be chick lit, or
they just think it's kind of an uncomfortable zone. And for somebody like me, I sit down and I write, and I am by no means writing as one gender to one gender. I am writing about why human beings do what they do. I am writing about difficult situations. I am writing about philosophies of art and life. And it's like a huge slap in the face to have half or nearly half of the population just say, sorry, you know, I just don't read books by women. And you have to hope it's going to change. I mean, there's so much change in the millennial generation around questions of gender identification and all of that, that you have to think this is just a kind of vestigial leftover bad thing.
We've got time for one more call, and that's Julie in Havertown. You're live on Radio Times. Hi, Julie. Julie, you with us? Oh, I don't think we
have.
Oh, hello. There you are.
Hello. There I am. Okay.
What's your question?
Oh, it's not really a question. It's sort of just an observation. I've been a non-writer for many, many years. I've always tried to write. I've always been very intimidated, you know, self-intimidated, just sort of refusing to do it. So in my later years, I started volunteering, believe it or not, for a national dog rescue organization. And I'm actually forced to write these simple little vignettes about the different dogs that we bring into our organization. It has forced me to write something. They have to be pithy, they have to be witty, and I'm very self-conscious about that. But what I found out was that the other members of the organization have really been enjoying them all along for all these years.
So, Julie, since we're running short on time, where do you think this is leading you?
I'm just saying that if you're writing, you're a writer. Just try to enjoy it, you know, and I think that's what Robin is saying, too, to sort of go for it, okay, you know, and whatever your medium is, it's a good medium, and it's probably what you should be doing. That's all. I just wanted to add that.
Well, we appreciate it, Julie. Thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. So, Robin, I think at the end of Crash Course, I believe it is, you say, you know, you were done. You're kind of empty. Are you still in that place where you don't feel you have more writing at the moment in you?
I'm gearing back up. I'm working on some short stories now, and I'm finding myself back in what I think of as kind of my fiction head, which is a little bit like walking around dreaming all the time. I definitely agree with that last caller. There's a line in the book in which I say, publication does not make you a writer. Writing makes you a writer. And I believe strongly that anyone who's writing is a writer.
One more quick question before we wrap up. Earlier in the show, when we were talking about your ADD diagnosis, you felt you were a failure a lot of the time. So now that you've kind of moved past that, you've been diagnosed, you're being treated, you've got 3 books under your belt, what's your sentiment about that?
I don't feel like a failure. I will say that writing this book, in which I kind of confess all that about shame and about failure and talk about the path out, is a big part of why I don't anymore.
Robin Blackett, was a pleasure.
A real pleasure.
Robin is author of Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide. And this note, our Facebook page is a great way to catch up. Just head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Emily Bryant, and Elizabeth Fiedler. Our intern is Nick Kowalski. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in this hour for Marty Moskowain. Thanks, as always, for joining us.